It's Tuesday, 16th of December 2014. This is HPR episode 1662 entitled Linux Lugcast episode 1 Outux. It is hosted by Kevin Wisher and is about 85 minutes long. Feedback can be sent to kevin.wisher@gmail.com or by leaving a comment on this episode. The summary is pre-show and after-show banter that does not get published through our normal feeds.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello, HPR community. This is Kay Wisher from the Linux Lugcast online lug community. We've decided to provide an HPR episode of our outtakes from our published content. That is, we start recording when we all get together on Mumble, so we have some pre-show banter and also some after-show banter. So what I'm doing here is taking the outtakes that we normally don't publish and combining them into an episode for your listening pleasure. I'll insert our normal intro music and outro music in between the two sections so that you'll know when each one starts and stops. Thank you for listening, and here we go. Okay, let's start chatting away. I mean, we can always cut out, edit out this, but it's good to capture the general chit-chat. We could cut this off and put it at the end like Tilts does as a pre-show chatter.
Yeah, bonus segment.
Dude, man, you're not going to talk? You got that great microphone?
But I didn't want to interrupt you guys. You know, I don't really know quite what's going on, so
disturb you. Here's kind of the general format we discussed. We're going to have at least one dedicated topic at the start of the show that one of the hosts is going to bring and discuss, and then we're going to open up the show for discussion about that topic and any emails, which we don't have yet, from listener feedback, and invite people that want to, you know, to chat with us about problems they may be having, and maybe we can offer a solution. And it's just going to be kind of an open discussion afterwards, like a roundtable discussion after the general topic and general discussion about that topic, if there's any questions amongst, you know, anybody about the topic. So that's kind of the way the initial format of the show is going to go.
Right, and this being our first one, the only thing we came up with was that we didn't expect to, heck, I probably personally didn't expect to see this many people in the room, which is awesome. Thank you for showing up. But this first one, we just kind of all figured we'd try to bring something just to try to fill in the space.
Well, question, are we going to wait for 5150 to join us? I saw he disconnected from IRC a couple minutes ago.
Says he's coming.
Okay, then, Kev and everyone, I'll leave my mic unmuted, so I'll try and join in a little bit.
Yeah, if nothing more, you can just at the beginning say hi, and then later on, if you have any questions about anything that was talked about or what somebody said, you can just kind of chime right in.
Okie dokie.
So I think we ought to start out by just kind of, you know, in the official recording, that whenever we get started here, it's kind of give the 300-foot view of what we're about, you know, how the show's going to go, what the community's about, just kind of give a brief
brief overview of what we're trying to do, and do we want to do, well, I guess we have to wait on 50 to see if he wants to talk about that Freenode topic he has in the show notes.
Are the show notes somewhere I can have a look at?
I just pasted them in the IRC.
Thanks. 5150 must have a big list of stuff, if it's anything like Kernel Panic.
D. Berialt, you most likely have an IRC client. If you're running Linux, you probably got a XChat or even Pigeon can be used for IRC. Or one of the terminal-based clients like Tankinator mentioned also, RSI or WeChat, or I can't remember all of them. And a fellow Arch user. I'm using Manjaro, so it's Arch-based.
This isn't an Arch podcast, is it?
No.
Shame.
Tankinator, if you look at our website, there's on the how-to page, there's a PDF file you can download to get an easy, quick setup.
Sorry for being late. I was talking to Tank in the IRC. I'm going to blame him.
Hey, 50, how you doing?
Oh, I can't complain too much.
Nice to hear.
Stream is live, if everybody knows that, too. We got a live stream. There's a link on the website. Tony was kind enough to give us a subdomain for a URL forwarder to my PiCaster.
Yeah, with me setting up the hosting, it's pretty easy. It's just a DNS setup, a line that you add in to make it a subdomain. And it's the same thing that we use. It's SMLR, so it's nice. And I want to thank Kevin there for letting us use your caster also.
No problem. It's a Raspberry Pi. It just sits there and hums along, sucking up very little energy, and it does its purpose. Well, Honky or 50, do you want to just bring your topic of the Freenode into the show?
Yeah, that's fine with me. I thought probably might be more appropriate to first talk about what the show was going to be about. But when we get done with that, yeah, I'm ready to give that presentation.
So are we all in agreement? We want to do these three topics, mine, Honky's, and 50's for tonight. Or do we want to just limit to one? Or do we want to do the two short ones, save 50's for the next episode so we don't run out of content?
Well, mine's pretty short. It shouldn't take long at all. Mine's just basically like a couple of steps in the GUI and then two steps in the command line, and that's pretty much it.
Mine's probably 10-15 minutes tops discussion without, any questions or anything.
Well, I mean, I think we should start with, who we are, what we're aiming at, there's going to be a live stream and we're going to start with at least one presentation from one of the hosts and then go into accepting or trying to answer questions that have either come in the previous week through email or through people in the IRC who are listening to the stream, or from people who are actually in the Mumble chat with us. And we mentioned the Mumble chat. I think we should say right off, I don't think it's set up yet, but the idea that we had that we're actually looking for a regular cadre of people to, come in each week, but we've decided to limit the total number and that probably the four original hosts will always have a slot. And then after that, it'll be up to 10 or 15, whatever we think is manageable. Is that a plan, guys?
Wait, you're going to mention how many people might be in the room at the same time? I think that might be just getting a little too detailed. I think maybe, 10 or 30 seconds. Like, this is a Linux user group, Lubcast. We talk about issues that people might be having, people might have solved, people might not have been unable to solve. and have a guest or two sometimes, and generally talk about what we've been up to and how we're working with Linux. Period.
Well, I think we ought to talk about how to contact the show with questions. You know, the email address that we have for the show, and then that, you know, we'll take, you know, if we don't have anything came up before the show to deal with, we'll take questions from the IRC of people who are listening to the feed, and we'll also take questions from people who are in the channel. I mean, that was something you guys brought up, that we might need, at some point, we might want to consider limiting the number of people actually in the Mumble channel. If you don't want to talk about that right away, you know, we can always leave that and say, hey, we've decided at this point that, you know, maybe we need that limit, or, you know, maybe writing it, because I think that's kind of off-putting myself. So maybe we could wait and see, you know, if it becomes a zoo or something like that, like some people are complaining about the old Linux basics. You know, not even mention having a limit on the Mumble channel at this point.
I agree. Until it becomes a problem, we don't want to limit anything.
Okay, it's great there, but I do think we need to run down that. Hey, if you have a question, you can submit it to feedback@linuxlugcast.org.
Com.
Is it com? Okay. And, you know, we'll try to have an answer for you. If you do it that way, we'll try to have an answer for you before the show, or you can listen to the live stream and, you know, interact with us at #LinuxLugcast, and we'll try to answer your questions that way. Or if you like, you know, we'll post the Mumble particulars and you can come on and join us on the show. But I think we should make clear, you know, the four of us are not expecting to be, oh, we're the hosts and that's going to be it. You know, we're trying to get, we're just the start of this thing, and we're trying to gather participation from the community.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree too. I think it's a nice, humble way to go about it, and you're not trying to be like a dictator or something. It fosters more communication and collaboration.
We have our first question through feedback from the feedback email from Dude Man himself.
I was wondering who was watching that and how quick it would be. That was about 25 seconds.
Fast on the trigger.
I meant for you to reply. Very good.
We're replying live. What else? What better could you get?
That's amazing. Really, truly amazing.
We're here to serve the community.
My life is to serve.
Well, who wants to give, like, start the show off and give, like, the 300-foot view of what we're doing here, and then we'll get going. It's 9:21 now.
Yeah, I've got to save my dad from the cat, so if somebody else wants to do that real quick, I'll be right back.
Honky.
Yes. All right, so am I kicking this off?
Fine by me.
So, where are we going, or are you guys just waiting for me?
Give me 2 minutes to figure out how I want to start this off, then, unless somebody else just wants to jump right in and kick it off.
Well, I kind of covered it. Let me give it an attempt, and if anybody says, no, that's not what we mean to do, you know, somebody else can redo it.
Tag, you're it.
And I hope I was not tuning into that podcast for everybody.
Yeah, no problem. You know, I've got a suggestion that maybe in the future, one of the presentation idea is to talk about, to talk about what you guys are using for your show notes. I think that's pretty cool. You can have multiple people editing at the same time.
That's Etherpad Lite is the name of that.
Oh, is it Lite? I thought you had the full-on Etherpad.
No, it's actually a turnkey VM that you can download from turnkey.linux, and it's actually running on a VirtualBox VM.
Okay, now is the one you had for the 24-hour show, was it full Etherpad? Because it looked like it had more bells and whistles.
Well, that was K5 Tux who provided that one.
Oh, that's right.
And I believe it was. I believe it, if I'm not mistaken, if he'll speak up and join us, I think it is the full Etherpad version, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he's muted both his mic and his headphones. He probably can't hear you right now.
Okay, yeah, because I use the same thing at home on my local server, Etherpad Lite. It's incredible.
Chatter, I won't need anybody to upload any audio to me unless I find out that mine is bad and I need a backup. So we'll just save that until I let you know it's ready to be published.
Thank you, because with my upload speeds, I think you might have to wait a while.
Well, even you know, in an emergency, you could convert that to AUG, and it would work out fine.
I did my recording in AUG, and it came out to 24 megs, you know, so it's much smaller than the 2.5 gig file.
Yeah, well, mine are WAV files. That's probably why they're so huge.
Yeah, I agree. WAV does take up a lot of space, and what I've noticed is that for voice like this, that the compression doesn't make that much of a difference. It's if you're going to doing more with recording music, that's where you don't want the compression. But for just voice chats and or even you know, reading books and stuff, that's where it really doesn't make that much of a difference with the compression of AUG.
Good point. Be right back.
D. Berryalt, you're welcome to unmute and join us if you want to help, if you need any help with your audio. Don't hear you. Seeing your lips light up, but nothing. Do you have, what distribution are you using? Arch, is that correct? Do you have Pulse Audio installed with the Pulse Audio Volume Control? You usually can go into Pulse Audio Volume Control and select the, make sure you get the correct input there. For instance, on mine, I'm using a USB headset mic combo. If you go to input devices, make sure you've got your mic device selected there.
Can you hear me now?
There you are.
Okay, that was stupid of me.
Oh, don't feel too bad. A couple weeks ago, I missed a show because I didn't realize or didn't remember I'd unplugged the USB mic and was trying to get it connected. Couldn't figure out why it wasn't present.
50, your audio did excellent tonight.
Thanks.
Not one stutter, except from you personally. But it seems your bandwidth was good tonight.
Well, that's always good to hear. Usually I can blame my bad performance on the bandwidth.
I think we need to have Dude Man do us some voiceovers. He's got that booming voice with the good Heil microphone there.
Welcome to the BSD log.
And he's got that sexy
accent. Something like that.
Got that sexy accent, too.
Well, only if we can get him his wife to accompany with the singing.
Yeah, she's awake. She's awake on her computer.
We do need some intro and outro little tune.
You serious?
I don't know. We haven't really voted on whether we're going to do anything like, you know, intro, lead in and lead out, you know, something short, 10-second lead in and lead out.
1, 2, 3.
Singku, singku, domalisi, Ach, singu, domalisi, tacicek septa, oralisi, tacicek septa, oralisi.
Yay!
Slip the word Linux in there and we got a theme song.
Yeah, as wonderful as always.
Maybe not so appropriate for the show, but just to prove she's awake at 3 a.m.
Yeah, we'll have to find out if the song's Creative Commons, though.
Yeah, it's an old folk song, so no problem there. Hey, 5150, have you spoken recently at all to Bi Brown? Is he still around?
Well, he posts quite regularly on G+. He's doing that, what's the sci-fi thing?
Scanner drone.
Yeah. So I see him every couple of days with a post on that.
Is he recording anything, or is it, that's a podcast, the drone thing?
He does one of those once in a while, like an interview or something. And he did originally about 6 months ago try to start like a lug up there in Pennsylvania online, and I think it went about 2 episodes, and that was as far as it got.
I missed that.
I thought he was actually trying to do a physical lug, but then this thing he was trying to do on the mumble was like something separate. I may be mistaken, but I thought he was actually trying to start a physical lug in his area.
No, it wasn't a physical lug. It was a more of a conference down in the Pittsburgh area.
I may need somebody's... Tony, I may need your help in getting reacquainted with archive.org. I've got the account set up, and I did back about a little over a year ago when we did the Linux Basics reboot thing, I did upload and get the RSS feed for that it produces, but it's been a while, so I can't remember the. I know it's kind of cumbersome to do that, isn't it? If I remember it correctly,
we're using just it as a file host, and all the RSS feeding and everything is off of WordPress. We use a plugin for WordPress called the Blueberry PowerPress. And it goes through and generates the feeds, and it puts a little player right onto each show notes page and everything.
So you don't, I think the way we were doing it for the Linux Basics thing, you had to use, and Dudeman probably can remember better than I can because he helped me once. It actually generated an RSS feed link.
I think, Kevin, that you were basically doing the same. I think you had the Blueberry plugin as well, but you just have to upload the file yourself to archive.org, which I remember every time I did it, I forgot where you've got to click. It's a bit of a pain in the ass, to be honest. Got to get the hang of it again. I'm guessing, Tony, it's not automated in any way, is it? The uploading of the files to archive, you don't have any command line method of doing it.
No, I do it all through the web interface, and not automated, but they have added a few features in the last 6 months that's made it really easy. And you can put in, I usually put it, instead of putting all the show notes into the archive.org, I put a link to our website where the show notes are.
Yeah, that's definitely easier to maintain, I would guess.
I recall a couple of years ago when we were all the HPRs up on archive.org, we were using FTP.
Yeah, I think you can use FTP if you don't want to use their web interface. So if it's just a matter of getting the show there, getting the file there, then what, and I've installed the Blueberry thing on that in on Word on our WordPress site, what link do you put into there? You have to get the link from the archive org site, correct?
Yeah, I think so what you do is you go through and you upload the file, and then it goes through and creates a page where archive.org also gives you a player, and like we have a MP3 and an AUG file. So when I upload two files every single time, and they are associated with the same show, So what you do is once it's there and you see the link where you can click to download it, I right click on that and say, get the source. I can't think what it's called right now at the moment.
Copy link location or something.
Yeah, that's it. And then you take that and you paste that right into on the show notes of your WordPress page. Below the body of the post is where the PowerPress line is. And you paste it in right there, and then you could go. And because we run two different audio, the MP3 and the AUG, then we use channels, I think.
I think we've decided to do MP3 and AUG. Is that everybody's feelings?
Yeah, if we're going to do both, that's fine.
Yeah, I think my feeling was just try not to leave anybody out.
I agree. That's why we went with both, so that the Windows people can play it straight from their Internet Explorer or iTunes, and then everybody else in the world can play AUG.
Now, do you guys do an iTunes feed, podcast feed?
It's not a special feed for iTunes. It's our MP3 feed. It has the iTunes tags in it, and then you have to install iTunes on a computer. You go in and you request or set up. Now it's been 2 years since I've done it, so I'm trying to remember. But you do some kind of request through iTunes.com and to get the feed set up, and then anybody can find it in their iTunes.
Yeah, I kind of briefly read the process, and it looked convoluted to me. But I think the PodPress will do a lot of that for you if you actually put the information in the iTunes section. Is that correct?
It'll go through and format the feed so iTunes can read it, but to actually get you published on iTunes so people using iTunes can find it through their search, you have to go through their website and you have to have iTunes installed on a computer.
Boo.
I agree. So I had to take my Windows VM, install it, get it set up, and then and then that was all I did with the VM.
Why do you need to have iTunes installed? Do you use that to upload it or to create something with it? Or
it's to get it registered with the iTunes service, basically.
Yeah, you have to have a username that iTunes will associate with your feed. But then in the setup, you just point it to your website feed that is the MP3 feed, and then it'll take it from there. And then, honestly, I set it up and forgot about it. I haven't touched it since.
So one of us needs to set up a iTunes account, or could I just like use my wife's account and set it up and grid, and it'll be underneath her name, but I don't think that'll matter, will it?
I don't think it makes a difference. I used a separate one just because I'm paranoid like that, but it's up to you guys. I mean, I personally would, like I did, I would use a separate account, but you don't have to have a credit card or anything associated with it, as far as I remember.
Yeah, you can do a free iTunes account.
Yeah, so we have two channels set up. We have one that is the MP3 feed that also does that formatting for iTunes. Then the second one is the AUG, and it's called Channels in the WordPress plugin. Because there's another way to do it where you can do multiple shows, and there's multiple channels, and you want to choose Channels. The other thing with the plugin that we're using is we're using the HTML5 player instead of the Flash player, just because, you know, with Linux and Flash, it's starting to phase out, and then also with some of the other devices, we did that. It also loads faster. Your web page will load faster with the HTML5 player. One more thing that we did is we have the feed on our website, smlr.us, and that's what the main, you know, anything that I do, edits on the show and posting shows, comes from that feed. But what we have published for people to use and grab is our that Google what's it called? Feedburner. So the traffic for pulling the feeds comes from Feedburner. And what's good about that is if you have a blip in your website, Feedburner will continue to be running where the website, if it goes down for an hour or something, if anybody tries to get to it at that point, then it won't go. But if you're using FeedBurner, then it always is running and people will always be able to get to it. So the combination of using the FeedBurner plus the archive.org for your file hosting, that people will always be able to get to your shows, even if something were to happen to the website for a period of time.
So, Tony, to do that, did you have to learn RSS, or were you able to just pretty much copy over that blue whatever plugin and copy the contents of that over the FeedBurner and make it work?
FeedBurner just points to our RSS feed. So the Blueberry Press sets up the two channels as two separate RSS feeds. And I went over to the FeedBurner and told it to reference our RSS feed. Now, it will reference it, and it keeps a cached file of our feed. And then from there, people will grab that cached file. So your traffic for FeedBurner is all going through the Google servers instead of pulling it off of the website or my server, which in the long run would probably help me out if you guys could do that so that I'm not keeping my bandwidth down. But then, like I said, it's for redundancy and for other reasons. It's a good thing to do. But as for your question about knowing how to format RSS, I have no clue. I didn't learn any of that because this plugin does it all for you. And I've actually been having an issue, and if you guys figure it out, let me know, where our AUG file, or our AUG feed, shows up as a video feed instead of as a audio feed. And I can't figure out any settings or what is causing that. So if you guys figure it out, let me know.
Well, I'm glad you explained that FeedBurner to me, because sometime this weekend, I've already set up an archive.org page. I've copied stuff over at least the dev randoms that I've been editing the last 6 months. I've been sticking them up on my Dropbox, but I'm gonna copy them over to archive and set up another Drupal Gardens page, which will and plug the links in. That'll automatically create an RSS feed for me. And so, thanks for that tip. I'll point FeedBurner at that RSS feed, and I should be good to go.
Yeah, that's great. And even FeedBurner is even better if you're running your own server at home and trying to host your web page off of it. If you have a blip, like you have to reboot your router or things like that, then, like I said, FeedBurner is always running. And it's also faster access for the feeds also, because it's on the Google servers.
Tony, when I paste your AUG feed RSS into, I'm just doing it in... Rhythmbox for a quick test. It doesn't even recognize it as a audio feed. It won't let me subscribe to it.
Okay. Yeah.
Nope. I'm sorry. It just did. Never mind.
Okay. And I think that's part of, we had other people say, hey, it's coming up as a video feed, not an audio feed. And I don't know what's really causing that. I've been going up and down that PowerPress plugin, and I can't find anything in there that's saying run it one way or the other. We have always just posted audio files to it. It's just, it's AUG. The only thing I think of is that maybe PowerPress thinks, because you can also have an AUG video file, maybe it's getting confused. I really don't know.
Tony, in the actual file that I just downloaded with wget, if you look in the media:content tag, there's a type equals quote video/AUG close quote. So maybe that's it. I don't know how that type portion gets put into the file, but that's what it shows when I just look at the text of the file I downloaded.
Yeah, and I've seen that, but like I said, it's the PowerPress plugin creates all that RSS stuff. I don't know if maybe I have to go into the PHP files and see where it's showing that, and maybe just manually force it to be audio. I'm not sure. I would think that there's like a click to say switch it from one or the other or turn off auto detect.
But just for your information, that's the feed that I use in GPodder, and whenever GPodder shows a new episode coming from SMLR, it's always showing as an audio file, not as a video file.
Yeah, I use GPodder also, and I've noticed the same thing. But if you, I'm running the newest version of GPodder right now, and if you were to delete our feed and then resubscribe to it, it puts it down in the video file section, like it splits it audio and video files. And then you have to go into GPodder and right click and, you know, in the settings and tell it that this is an audio, not a video files. I mean, it still plays it as an audio, but it, it thinks it's a video feed still.
Yeah, I'm on GPodder 2.20 dot something. I tried to migrate to, I think it's 3.5.2, and I had some Python problems, so I'm sticking with 2.20.
That's probably a good thing. When I switched over, it blew away all my subscriptions, and the only way to get it back was I had to uninstall the 3, reinstall the 2 version, export the OML file, and then uninstall and then reinstall the new version, and then re-import that file.
Are you on Debian or some other distro?
Yeah, Debian. I'm using Ubuntu, but it's just my podcast player at work.
Because I know in the Debian .deb file, there's a script called migrate to trace. That's the number 2 and then TRES. And that script needs to be run before you start up GPodder 3. That will migrate all your GPodder 2 subscriptions and downloads to whatever version 3 something uses for their format.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I mean, I did the switch about a year ago, but yeah, that would have been nice to know at that point. But I think they switched from like a flat file format to a database format for keeping all the data running.
I remember
that's why the big difference was.
I've also been having trouble with GPodder 3 because GPodder 2 was GTK 2 and GPodder 3 is GTK 3. And I ran into problems with GPodder 3 and with Liferia, the RSS feed reader that I use. The version of Liferia 1.8.5, I think, uses GTK2 and 1.10.3, which is what's available in Debian testing. 1.10 uses GTK3. And I was getting unwanted behavior in certain mouse activity with the GTK3 applications, both GPodder and Liferia, or Liferia. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I let the distro pretty much handle that stuff for me, and I'm not I don't get that deep into that stuff. Although I'm for my main workstations, I've gone away from Ubuntu because I don't like Unity. I'm using Mint with the Cinnamon desktop, and I love it.
Well, let me throw the question out then. Is there anybody that's using GTK3 applications currently? Using the applications on a regular basis? I guess that's a no then.
I honestly don't really know or don't know the difference between the GTK2 and GTK3 to really say whether I'm using one or the other.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to tell you without doing some research.
Yeah, you don't have to be running GNOME Shell to run the GTK3 applications, do you?
No.
Yes. Yeah, see, I am not one of those people who ever said, okay, I'm going to install either GTK or I'm going to install Qt, and then I'm going to be very careful and not cross over the applications because I don't want to make my system bigger by pulling in all those libraries. One thing, I'm not good enough to know what I was doing on that. But I usually prefer a lighter desktop than either one.
Yeah, I see what you're saying with lighter desktops. But I find, you know, most of my machines are dual core or better. So I honestly, I like the eye candy of the, you know, GNOME shell with Cinnamon, you know, some of that graphic or the animation.
I think if I remember correctly, that I'm using XFCE, and they're not implementing GTK3 until the next major release, if I remember correctly. I can't remember what podcast I heard talking about in-depth on XFCE.
Yeah, see, that was something that came up during the after show on HPR. Somebody's going off, well, he liked XFCE, but they had... Oh, they were never going to go they decided never to go GTK3, so they would, you know, they were always going to be marginalized. And I brought that up on another show. It says, no, whoever said that is behind the times. They are definitely incorporating GTK3 libraries.
I just did a quick search through my graphical package manager on Manjaro for GTK, and most of the apps were showing 2. Something or another.
Well, let me ask you then, Kevin. When you have a GTK2 application open, and the content inside the window is the content is larger than what can be displayed in the window, so you need to scroll down. You have a sliding scroll bar trough at one side. Is that correct? Hope that's clear.
Say that again, because you said a GTK3 app. Is that correct?
No, I'm sorry. I meant a GTK2 app. Let's say you open up a GTK2 app, and it can be any kind of GTK2 application. If what's being displayed within the application's window is larger than what can be displayed in just the window, so you need to scroll down or page down, you have a sliding scroll bar on one side of the application. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, for instance, I use HexChat and for IRC, and there are sliding bars both vertically and horizontally for content that overfills the three panels.
Good. So that's a good app. That's a good example. When you move your mouse cursor into that scroll bar and you do one mouse click, one left button mouse click, does the content of the of what's in the display move up by one page, or does it hop to the spot in the scroll bar trough that you've clicked on?
It moves to where my mouse clicks on.
Is there a way that you know of to make it move up or move down by one page at a time per mouse click?
No, I do not know that.
Okay, because the one page per mouse click is what I've become accustomed to, and how the GTK2 applications that I run behave, and the GTK3 applications did not have that behavior. Instead, what's displayed within the window hopped or skipped to the spot in the scroll bar where I mouse clicked, and I wanted it to do it one page at a time instead.
So that's the GTK setting in GTK3, and it's not a mouse setting?
If it is, I don't know how to change it to make it behave the way that I want it to. I've asked a couple of places, and I've not gotten any helpful suggestions yet.
Now, when I right-click in that trough, the scroll bar trough, it goes up one page at a time.
Ah, that's interesting. I hadn't tried that. In your hex chat window, do you have tabs open up, like your Firefox tabs, but within hex chat? Do you have tabs displaying along the top or along the side of the application?
No, I don't have tabs.
Okay. Because that's another behavior that changed between GTK 2 and GTK 3 here. With the GTK 2 tabs, if I move the mouse cursor up to the tabs, I could use my scroll button, scroll wheel on my mouse to move along the tabs. And with GTK 3, the scroll mouse button didn't do anything with those tabs. And likewise, I've asked about that problem in a couple of places and not gotten anything helpful in reply.
50, do you, on that host, that guest you're having tomorrow night, that school system, is that, I think, if I tried to, after you mentioned that he was, I think, a senior G-plus post he was going to be on, I was trying to find that some articles, read about that a little bit more, and is it correct that 1700 is just the high school class body that's getting those laptops? Hello?
Hey, Kevin.
Did you hear my question?
I'm sorry, I was out for a minute.
Oh, on that, the guest you're having tomorrow night for that's doing the Linux laptops, did I read correct that 1700 students is just the high school students?
Oh, I thought that was the entire district. It could be, maybe just the high school students.
If that's the entire district, that's pretty small district.
The district I work for, they have about 10 kids in a class.
So it's at one school corporation, or is it like the whole county, or?
Well, it's a Penn Manor district. I don't think that covers the entire county. It's like Millersville or something. Because I looked it up. I wanted to see how close we were going to be when we're going to be at OCP Live come May.
So we average about 100 per class. So that's, you know, K through 12, that's roughly 1,300 students in our corporation.
Well, that's what my high school that I went to is about 100 per class. The one that I've been doing work for over the years, 20 is a huge class. 10's about average. And they lost their high school a few years ago. Well, a lot of people think it was silly, but, you know, the Greensburg tornado, there was these three schools that sort of had agreements and stuff. You know, Greensburg was in the center, and then to the west you had Mullenville, and to the east you had Haviland, which is the one I work for. And Haviland was probably nearly as big as Greensburg. And so when all the schools got wiped out at Greensburg, Mullenville and Haviland would have been easily big enough to pick up the slack for a year or so till they got a new school built at Greensburg. But instead, Greensburg, you know, spent all their insurance money on setting up schools in like trailers over there. And then, sorry, the cat's playing with my headphone cord. You know, then tried to get government money and grant money to rebuild their new school. And to get the school big enough, they said, you know, oh, we'll close the school to the west, and we'll take the high school, we'll take all the high school students from the school to the east. And of course, the real estate taxes went up ridiculously in the whole county because of all that. But so the school I had, you know, the school that I do stuff for now, they lost all the high school, and so they've only got the grade school and the middle school now, and I think handwriting's on the wall. Eventually they consolidate the whole thing, which gives some of the kids from the school I work for like an hour's ride on the bus every day if they had to do that. Did any of that come through, Kevin?
Oh yeah, yes. I was just curious about that situation in Pennsylvania, actually, if that was like one school corporation or actually, you know, what grade levels that was.
Well, I think you're right. I think it is higher grade levels. And I'm surprised, though. I guess at that level, it does make a difference. I mean, one of the things they cited was the cost of the software contracts. You know, where I work, it's, you know, when there's maybe 200 seats total, I think it's less than that now that the high school's gone, but, you know, when they can get Office for $50, so I think it's more than that now. For years, they were able to buy Office Pro for $50-$60 on the academic plan. You know, I just couldn't sell open source to them. You know, they weren't the, you know, a few of the computers like in the library said, well, we don't need, you know, they're not going to be doing their assignments there. They, you know, I'll throw open office on them. And then I got nothing but complaints, and they didn't, you know, they didn't know they could save it in a compatible format. I set everything up to save by Office by default, but you know, after 6 months, no, this thing is not what we're using every place else. Just buy six copies of Office Pro and throw it on there. I'll be back in just a minute.
Kevin, I put three links in the Mumble chat about the project and, you know, I guess the rollout.
Thank you.
But, you know, Chad, you know, even all his experience in open source, as far as he was ever able to go when he worked through K-12 was to install open source applications on top of Windows. You know, he never got to this point where he could actually, you know, do an open source operating system.
Yeah, I know. It's a crying shame, the money that Apple and Microsoft make off of school systems.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. I mean, when I was brought in, see, the first couple years I worked for the school, I just served the district office. I wasn't at all involved in student computers and stuff. They had a teacher that did that for them, and he wasn't able to continue. He moved on. So they asked, you know, can you come, you know, service the whole school? I was like, great. But one of the first things, the superintendent who was there then, you know, guy's still my friend now, but, you know, he was like, yeah, you know, and this was about the end of the time Apple giving away computers to schools almost. But yeah, we have these labs full of Apple computers, but you know, when the kids graduate and they go out in the world, they're going to be using Windows. And that was one of the first things I did was sit down with the board and say, yeah, you know, that's right. You know, you're not going to see many Apple computers in an office these days. And so, you know, from then on, every computer they bought was a Windows box. So, you know, having said that to this school a good 10 or more years ago, you know, I would like somebody to give me pointers. Okay, how do I say, yeah, let's go open source. And it's just like Ahuka has been saying, we shouldn't be teaching an operating system. We should be teaching computing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I know that uphill battle, even in, it's not just Office that they get really cheap. It's the Windows OS also that they get practically free because, you know, they're just giving it away to schools. So I can't think of anything. You know, I'm not in that situation every day. I work at a hospital, not a school. But I can see where your question is, and I would be interested in a good rebuttal to that also.
Well, it's not even just Microsoft. It's Adobe applications. They're not as incredibly ridiculously cheap as Microsoft, but they're probably about half price. One thing got them off Apple. Well, they used to have the like the journalism class was, well, I guess it was still separate. They had a journalism teacher, or the English teacher taught journalism, and she was like, no, Macs are everything. You gotta have a Mac to do journalism. And so the last thing we purchased was like these two $1,800 G5s, and that was without peripherals, you know, another $300 or whatever for 17-inch monitors on the things. But, you know, they were dual processor, but no, these were the single processor G5s. But then the next year, the journalism teacher retired, and the computer teacher kind of took that over. Well, computer teacher, general things, but, you know, she had a lab full of Windows machines, and they found out that these $400 Windows machines would run this Adobe software at least as well or better than the $1,000 Macs. But a lot of stuff is facilitating this just in the last couple of years. A lot of this used to be client-server based on Windows, or, you know, the people doing the yearbooks, Jostens, essentially, the people used to sell you overpriced class rings. But, you know, they always used to insist everything coming out of the whole huge Adobe suite. Trying to think of it. Adobe Imagine? No, that's not it. But what, you know, but you had the Photoshop and the publisher and all that stuff. But now they've got everything essentially online for that. So you can do a lot of your pre-work, but essentially then you got to take it and stick it in the online form. And then all this other software that used to have to run client server locally is now all web-based as well. So yeah, unless the people who are running the web servers are complete jerks, everything can be platform agnostic.
I'd like to the guy from Pennsylvania tomorrow night. I'd like to know how they do any time if they're totally Linux on their back end, as far as, you know, servers go and everything. I'd like to know how they manage these machines. Do they have a centralized, are they using Red Hat or Novell, and how, if they have any type of AD, Microsoft AD environment, you can push out policies to computers, and if there's any way to do that on the Linux side, and how they authenticate into a server, that type of stuff. That'd be something I'd be interested in knowing. That was always my dilemma on trying to get, trying to suggest a lab of Linux machines, small lab of Linux machines for students, to is how you would manage that and how you get students to authenticate in. And then they have to authenticate into our filter system, or Lightspeed system for filtering. You know, it's single sign-on now. I mean, everything's just, once they log into a computer, they get the proper policies through Lightspeed, which talks to Active Directory and everything. It's kind of seamless on that side of it, but I've never tried it or investigated it too deeply on how you do that on a Linux, systems.
Yeah, we had Lightspeed for about 3 years until the reduction in the size of the school, it became for them cost prohibitive. So we're just renting services on the router now for filtering. But I'll see if they're doing anything like that. I kind of got the impression they were giving students root access, their Ubuntu laptops, you know, and encouraging them to experiment. But that's one of my questions. Well, yeah, but if they go around, they completely they're playing with configurations and stuff, or they, you know, what they installed, they completely abort the system. They, you know, do you guys just say, okay, give me the laptop and we'll re-image it, or, you know, what happens then? Because, I mean, you're teaching them Linux, you're not really teaching them Linux unless they've got root. And Kevin, if you want, you're more than welcome to join us tomorrow night.
I will try to make a point of it.
Same server and everything. Because I bet you could get your point across on that question a lot better than I can remember it. I see where you're going. But, you know, like I said, see, it seems to me central control is across purposes from teaching these students Linux. I got to step out for just a minute. I'll be right back.
As Dude Man enters the room. Is it only you here still, Kevin?
Oh, I think everybody's still here. Speak up if you're still awake.
Yeah, I'm still awake. I'm just busy. I'm working on some computers right now.
Tony, are you a consultant, or do you have a full-time 40-hour-a-week job, or what do you do to earn money?
I'm a field tech at a hospital in our area. It's the Oakwood Health Systems, and I do death site support. So my office is in the hospital. I receive tickets from the help desk, and I walk out to the desk and either fix, you know, printers, computers, monitors, or either train people. You know, I do, you know, more of user education on, like, click this, don't click that. I don't train them completely on all their systems, but you know, break fix kind of things mainly.
Right. Okay. So, in other words, you don't, your Linux activity is after hours.
Yeah, exactly. I run my own small business, you know, with hosting websites and doing computer repair. And actually, right now, I'm tearing apart a computer and replacing a motherboard on a laptop. But you know, everything I use for running my business is all Linux and open source. And every chance I get somebody to move over or use Linux, then I'll sell them a laptop with Linux on it. But the majority of the time, it ends up being that it already has the key for Windows, so I ended up just giving it to them with that. But I did get my parents, my mom's on the Linux laptop, and my sister is, and a couple other people I got moved over. How about you guys? What's your day jobs?
I am a network system administrator at K-12, K-12 school system here where I originally went to high school and been there for 4 years now. It's my first IT job. I had a major career move when I took this job. I'd gotten laid off from the skilled trades. From high school till 4 years ago, I was a journeyman injection mold maker, and then that got into towards the latter 10 years of that career, I got into doing the CAD design of injection molding. So when I got laid off because of jobs being shipped overseas, this area is, you know, of course, like you, Tony's up around, there's major automotive industry here. We got three or four Chrysler plants, and then it used to be a big GM plant that's almost down to nothing now. But all the automotive jobs, you know, stuff got sending overseas, and just really hurt the small job shop market around this area where I worked.
Yeah, you know, the biggest thing that came out of with the big three and how, you know, they were debating whether to let the GM and Chrysler go under or to bail them out. And if you think about it, the GM and Chrysler is only a third of the, you know, what goes into actually making the cars. There's, you know, two times more than just GM and Chrysler. That's all the supporting companies and even restaurants and businesses around them. You know, the main hospital I work at is in Dearborn, which is where Ford is at. And there was worries whether Ford was going to be liquid enough to keep going or whether they were going to have to cut back. And that would even affect us, because if Ford were to pull out or reduce workforce, then people aren't going to be able to afford to stay in the area or get medical care. So then, you know, that, you know, trickles down to the hospital in the area is going to have less, you know, business.
Well, I always thought the proper solution to that was to send our fast attack subs out and sink all the Japanese imports.
Funny.
Now, Kevin, you talk about the Lightspeed server. Like I said, the school decided they couldn't afford that service about 3 years ago. And, of course, I'm sure where you are, it's like we are. It's provided by a third-party company, set it up and all that, and it's their lease server. So I pulled it out of the rack and told them to come pick up their server. And it's like a dual processor, dual core server. It's been sitting there 3 or 4 years, and the school has no use for it because the server they've got now, since everything has moved to the web, is it's Active Directory and a file server, and that's about all it does. This perfectly good rack server is sitting on top of a pile of single core laptops that they waited too long to do anything with, and they'll probably, the only way they'll ever get rid of them is send them to the dump. I swear that thing is going to find its way in the back of my pickup next time I'm up there.
Sometimes I miss not having any kind of IT job, you know, not having access to some of that old kit. I would be pretty active getting stuff into the back of my truck, like you, 5150.
Well, most of the stuff for years, they've given me when it's got, you know, when it, you know, I've got stacks of Pentium 4 Dells and the stuff, the jobber machines they had before that. But the last, you know, it was all some of the stuff they got in. It's just too, you know, they took it offline. They couldn't use it, but they wouldn't sell it to the faculty or the students or the members of the community. And they waited till the stuff was useless. You know, it was like, so the faculty machines, when I took one of them out, I always did a D-band and wiped it. Now, student computers I didn't do anything with because I figured, well, there probably can't be anything on there. Probably full, maybe vulnerable to viruses and stuff. But, you know, as far as a secure, you know, as a privacy deal, there shouldn't be anything on there. But they, you know, came up, a couple summers ago. They said, well, you work on these computers and, you know, and clean them up and, you know, and the ones that are wiped, will you put Windows back on? And it's like, look, you cannot sell these computers for enough money to pay me to look at them. A couple years ago, when you took them offline, yeah, maybe you could have.
They've just waited too long, haven't they? And you don't have to wait long nowadays for the computer to become out of date.
Yeah, I said, you know, these things are, I'd be amazed if you get $25 out of them. That's what I charge them for an hour. I'm cheap. And, I told them I can't reinstall Windows and all the, wipe them, reinstall Windows and all the drivers in an hour and update them.
Fog to the rescue.
You know, I told him you should have given these things away, you know, sold them for a little bit of something or given them away years ago. Now you're just going to send, I mean, they did have their thing. And, well, first, the ones that I'd wiped, you know, they sent home with me. So that's why I've got so many of them. But the others, student machines, I guess they did sell a bunch of them, but they were like without documentation, without, you know, without disk probably. You know, good luck with with those at home, and it was a centralized antivirus system, so the antivirus is no good to them. But I guess they got something out of them, and then a couple of them didn't sell, and they were on the trailer to go to the dump. And the monitors, I grabbed them because I've always had agreement. Well, if it's on the trailer to go to the dump, you know, iron or whatever, if I can grab it, that's cool. Old furniture, stuff like that. I've done that a few times, but they do have a stack of laptops in the corner, single core laptops that, yeah, if somebody installed Linux on them, they would be usable. With XP, they're not for crap.
Yeah, I'm sure you could find some good homes for them, you know, just as for learning machines and tinkering and get some light distro on there. Could be useful.
Well, it's like my truck club. They wanted to have a few for the officers a few years ago. And I said, well, yeah, I could probably get you these. And this has got to be 6 years ago now. And it's like, no, you know, just complete indecision. And they're just still sitting there in corners. And it's like, yeah, well, there were a few. Well, a few of them came with a grant. And they'd come with a couple scanners, and they said, you know, after the first year, they said, no, we want them all, you know, if the computer is connected to the scanner dies, we want them all set up with scanner and webcams and all that. And there was something in there in one of the, I think it was the webcam program. If you installed that, it always, when you shut down, gave you two or three errors you had to close out of in Windows. But, you know, your HP, so you had the HP update on top of the Windows update installed by default, which is completely useless and always was nagging you and all that stuff. And it's like, yeah, I could install a Linux distro on this, make a decent little machine out of it, but you know, forget it with XP, it's beyond its day.
How long did you try installing ZoneMinder some time ago?
Oh, I installed it on the server. I don't think I spent that long on it. But like I said, I've got those cheap IP cameras that came out a year ago that were easy to hack. So,
which ones are they?
All those ones that are about $60. I'm trying to think of the name of them.
Can you connect it with VLC or MPlayer or something like that to the stream?
Oh, on the camera? No.
Yeah. So there's not any kind of HTTP or RTP kind of stream.
It's a web server on the camera.
I'm pretty sure there must be like a network URL that you can type in from a browser. Well, maybe not a browser, but definitely from VLC and just stream the video. I think that's fairly normal on even the cheapest ones.
Well, that may be possible then. It was like, I don't know. I installed ZoneMinder. I can't remember what it was, but it never seemed like it even started working right.
I tried it about a year ago. I remember when we used to chat on the lugs on Saturday mornings, and I got the impression that it was easier to set up and install and it would just work, and I gave up too soon, you know. And this time I really wanted to get it to work and have, you know, but I spent a long time playing with it, but it's working. And I'm really impressed with it as well, actually. And I have a pretty cheap webcam, IP cam, and I'm trying to get a few more as well. But I'd be interested in what model you got, you know, if it was something that was easy to hack.
Let me go look at it real quick, I can tell you.
Thanks, 50. The webcams really saved my life because I installed a really simple webcam in the cow shed just before they were giving birth, a few days before they should give birth. And I was able to not have to keep going out to the shed every 20 minutes to see if she'd given birth yet, but I could sit in the comfort of my own computer. And just the moment the baby came out, the little calf came out, I could go out and deal with it. You know, it was wonderful.
That's nice. And is that where you used the ZoneMinder? Was to, you know, whenever they started having activity, or I guess they're always moving, so it'd be hard to use ZoneMinder for that, right?
Well, at the moment I have it on, I'm kind of just testing it. I want to get some more webcams around the house, kind of on the front entryways and what have you, but I'm waiting for them from eBay. But so I'm just testing it out with motion detection, and it's interesting to see how much they stand up and sit down. And I have a problem. There's always chickens walking past, you know, so they alert it, but it's no problem. But it's really nice to be able to sit inside and see what the hell they get up to, you know, not have to keep going out and seeing what they're doing. And they don't know I'm looking either, you know, haha.
Yeah, the brand is Foscam. I should have remembered that.
Were they like megapixel?
Well, they have audio, they have tilt and pan. And I think they're like maximum 640 by 480.
And you got yours off eBay, did you?
A link on Woot, deals.woot.com. They're not hard to find.
Ah, these are kind of indoor cams with Wi-Fi little antennas, are they?
Yeah, but they also have Ethernet. You have to set them up via the Wi-Fi because they act as a server. So you got to connect to them first through Wi-Fi. But if but then you can set a static address on them and plug in the cabled Ethernet.
Yeah, but I've got something a bit similar to this, a bit more expensive, kind of a better brand one, kind of an indoor camera, but without the Wi-Fi. I'd be surprised. I mean, all the IP cameras, I think, have a web interface on them and kind of the little server, little Linux server. I'd be really surprised, 51, if you wanted to get it working, I bet you could. You've just got to look in the settings and find, there must be like a network section in the settings, and there it would specify either HTTP kind of stream connection point or something called RTP. And then you can use that URL and the port inside a VLC or mPlayer, and you can test that you can view remotely. And you just basically use those settings in the ZoneMinder. But it isn't terribly intuitive to know how to get the ZoneMinder going. You do have to read the docs, which I'm not very good at, but I finally did after banging my head up against the wall.
Well, I'll have to get back to that sometime. One of the things that I found I didn't like, if I hit them through a PC, the tilt in the pan works fine. But if I try to do it through an Android device, the controls don't work at all.
It has an ActiveX control. That's what all the cheap ones, I think, are limited by.
Well, you're probably right, but there's an ActiveX login page and there's a not an ActiveX login page.
Oh, right. On my one, it has only ActiveX, and it's a real pain in the ass. So I have to run Internet Explorer under Wine just to move it around, you know. But I don't use it. You know, I don't use it to move around too much.
Well, see, these, when they lose power and they reset, they kind of point up to the ceiling, so you almost have to have.
Yeah, I know what you mean. What were you going to watch? Just out your front gate or animals or?
Well, my dad is close to being an invalid, you know, so I've got one in the living room where I can, you know, I can log in, watch him if I need to. And
that's a good idea.
I do have one out the machine shed that I can connect to.
Kind of as a security.
Exactly. And Hull, you know, I don't use him as much as I should. I mean, when I first put him in, I played him as a toy, and then, you know. But the one thing, you know, they're both LED. And
oh, the infrared, that's really nice.
Yeah, they're infrared. But at least the one out in the shed, I don't know. It seemed like the LED may be overused or whatever. It doesn't have the range that it used to do when it's completely dark. And somebody, well, it was actually the guy I know in the sheriff's department. He said, well, all you need to do is set up a row of LEDs against the back wall and leave them lit up all the time. You know, it's great. I was surprised. That's a great idea.
You can also get really cheap off eBay these kind of just infrared LED lights, which have like a light sensor, so they only turn on in low light conditions, and they can go like 20, 50 meters. You can get all sorts of different power ones. And it was like, I got one for about $15 or $10 or something. And so you just plug the power in, point it in the same direction as your camera, and it can extend the range.
And I did have some, well, I still do, not that I pay much attention, because it's, they do have motion sensors on these cameras. And I set the one up in the machine shed with motion sensor. But every time I look at it, I see a sequence of pictures, and I don't know what it sees moving. So I don't know if it's the cats out there or what it is, but
I think I just had the wrong button press when I was going to tell you that you can get external infrared lights, which have light sensors, so they only work at nighttime. Cheap off eBay. I picked up one for about $5 or $10, and so you can extend the range, you know, up to 50 meters, something like that.
No, I heard that, and that's exactly what I was thinking of when, you know, I just haven't. You know, it's like I have so many interesting projects to do, and it's like, because there's so many of them, none of them ever get done.
That's like me as well, 50. I go through phases where I try not to do any other jobs, so I take some time off work, and then I kind of push forward a little bit. I buy some more gadgets, but it's never quite finished, you know. I was really pleased with myself. I got the Zone Minder and some other stuff. I'm working on one of these Odroid little devices, which I want to set up as the Zone Minder kind of monitor for all the webcams.
Yeah, how are you going with the Odroid? I know Jezzer's talked about, you know, he put his into making a clock or something because he just got tired of it. And I've noticed I've had a couple different distros on them. And it's like maybe it's what I'm doing. It seems like, you know, I'll use it half a dozen times and then it won't boot to the same card. And, but the card, you know, I can read and write to the card. I can reflash the card. So it doesn't seem like that's it.
Did you ever get one of those kind of the high speed memory modules? I think it's called EMMCP modules with it.
No, I haven't.
I would definitely recommend that. I mean, it's as fast as an SSD card, and it's much more reliable if you have any power cuts. The little memory cards, the SD cards, I find so unreliable. Even with the little Raspberry Pi I have, you know, you get a few power failures, and then the damn thing won't boot, and you've got to take it off and put it somewhere else and do a file system check and what have you. So I think I've never had any problems like you mentioned with that memory card, and it's much faster.
Oh, I didn't realize that could be the problem. Okay, yeah, I'll check that out because I never got, because it seems so much more expensive. But if that's the limiting factor, definitely it's the way to go.
It's so fast as well. I mean, I just bought the U3, which is the same power and specs as the X2, but instead of $120 or $150, it's only $58. And I bought one of those, a 64-gigabyte, one of those memory cards. And, you know, I'm seriously thinking about just getting another one for my wife for her computer, you know. You see so much less power, and it's pretty powerful. I really like it.
Well, the difference is mainly less USB ports, isn't it?
That's right, and you haven't got that big expansion port as well. There's a small kind of serial port, so you can plug. They've got a little daughter board for Arduino, if you like more hardware hacking. You can bolt an Arduino board onto it, which they have, which I got as well.
Oh, okay. Because yeah, that long connector they had was really only to plug in video and turn into a tablet. I've never seen anything where they were actually using that as the pinouts like on the Raspberry Pi.
You could do. You'd need to plug some other board onto it. I mean, if you're a bit more clever with hardware and plugging stuff in, you could take those I/O ports off. But the U3, I'd be really surprised if. The price point and the power of it, I'm amazed that more people with Raspberry Pis don't get it, because I've got a Raspberry Pi and it's just so damn slow. You know, it's really, I mean, it's a good thing, but for just twice the money, you know, you can get 4-core Odroid and it's so much nippier.
Yeah, and is that the one that also it's sort of the case acts as a heat sink?
No, they've changed the design a bit. It's even smaller. It's about the size of a credit card now, and they have a little plastic box that they've made nicely, and you can get a little plastic box as well for it. You can get an extra fan if you're going to overclock it, if you're worried about it overheating and what have you. They've even got for the same price point as the X2 from last year, they have an 8-core. A15 version, and I think it. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it works in like a little or big mode, where if you're not using it much, it uses four of the slower processors, and if you really want a lot of power, it switches over to using four of the.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.